This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tye.
And I'm Bonnie North. We have done quite a few interviews over the years about where education in the STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math, fits into the 21st century economy. In particular, there's been a concerted effort to attract more girls into the field so that someday there will be more women in engineering and tech fields. Girls can follow in the footsteps of astronomer Annie Jump Cannon, who cataloged 350,000 stars, or perhaps Changsheng Wu, the first lady of physics who worked on the Manhattan Project.
Or they could try not to be left in the dust by Julia Landauer, who advocates for girls in STEM as she competes as a NASCAR driver. Landauer is also a Stanford graduate and a former competitor on the TV show Survivor. She will give the keynote speech at the Mount Mary University Voices of Leadership event this month. But ahead of that, she joined us by phone from her home in North Carolina. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's go to your origin story, if we could. What was it that first drew you to auto racing? I mean, was speed part of who you were before that point?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I like going fast on my bike in Central Park. But what it was really was that my parents were looking for an activity that all of their kids could do together on the weekends. They're me and my two siblings. And then they were also looking for an activity that their girls could do head-to-head against the boys, you know, up all the levels of the sport. And so racing is one of the few, and I started in go-karts, and I loved it right away. I loved, you know, the speed. I really loved winning, and, you know, beating the boys was really cool at age 12. And then I also really appreciated working with adults and the human-machine interaction and getting that technical and mechanical experience. And being held accountable for my part in making a race go well. So it was just really exciting and a lot of adrenaline.
Well, and it sounds like from the very beginning, the message was that that gender wasn't the most important thing here, that you could compete on a level that anybody could compete at.
Yeah, and I'm definitely quite lucky that I have the parents that I have, right? And, you know, they fully believe that their girls and boys could do anything. And, you know, they held their son to the same, you know, emotional IQ that they held their daughters, and they held their daughters to the same, you know, physical, mechanical, you know, IQ that they held their son. So it was really, really lucky. And at the end of the day, I think that there are so many like externally imposed barriers to women, to minorities, that if you can break those down, that's where you really see some magic happen.
It's funny. You were saying you're riding your bike in Central Park. New York City is not necessarily a place where everybody has a car, especially a kid.
Yeah. Well, funny enough, I didn't actually get my driver's license till I was 18, just because if that, you know, in New York, you can't get it till you're 18. But yeah, I mean, it wasn't a normal sport for the city. And so we went to a go-kart track that was about 2 hours outside of New York City. The same go-kart track that Marco Andretti, you know, grandson of Mario Andretti, raced at. And it really became the weekend family activity. And there was 1 year where we raced 27 weekends out of the year. And so it was quite a lot. And we traveled to the national races, which were, you know, in the Midwest and the South. And so it was really cool. Actually, one of my favorite go-kart tracks was in Wisconsin. So
really?
It was up in Shawano, Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
How long did it take for you to figure out that you liked it and that you could be good at it?
Well, I won my first race, like in my sixth or seventh race of my rookie season in go-karts. And that really was kind of the addictive moment. But I had a really clear idea that this was something I wanted to pursue right about the time I was 12, which again, I realize is totally lucky to kind of have that epiphany so early. But that being said, you know, every year my parents, you know, made sure that I was willing to do the hard work to keep racing and that I was willing to make the sacrifices that would have to be made. So they helped keep me grounded. And I saw that there were other 12 and 13 year olds who were getting into racing cars specifically, not go-karts. And I thought, if they can do it, I can do it. And so I worked with my parents and, you know, they supported me and we did the research. And, you know, every year I knew that I was going to have to put a lot in, and I knew that my parents were not going to be able to pay for racing, you know, till the end of time. And so, you know, really understanding the business side of it became very important and something that I had to addressed early on. I wasn't just able to go out and race and just have fun with it, right? I had to look at it as a career, therefore as a business.
Right. And of course, not every NASCAR driver goes to Stanford. Why was it important that, that education was an important element of who you wanted to become?
Yeah, education's always been really important. And I went to a high school that specialized in math and science. It was a public school, but it was one of, the specialized public high schools in New York City. So I had this emphasis on academia and STEM. And so for me, there were a couple of things. One, kind of going back to the business side, I knew that I was going to have to become smarter about how I presented myself, how I marketed myself, how I presented ROI to a potential investor or sponsor. So there was that component. But then there was also just the interest from the technical standpoint of racing. You know, there's a lot of cutting edge technology going on in Silicon Valley from the digital side, from the autonomous side. And then there was racing, which is a very tech-centric sport. And so for me, I was always interested in how could I bridge those worlds, whether while I'm racing or when I retire from racing, you know, how can I continue that endeavor of marrying Silicon Valley and racing, if you will.
Do all drivers have that kind of technical sophistication or at least attitude towards it?
Well, I think you can't be a dummy and go racing, right? You cannot be dumb and operate a machine at 200 miles an hour within inches of a wall for hours on end. So I think that's a bad rep that some racing can have. But, you know, it varies. I think there are a lot of drivers that do have a very strong technical understanding of the vehicle, and they understand the physics involved with it and vehicle dynamics, even if it's not from a formal education setting. From being hands-on with their car and getting on the track every weekend, a lot of people learn that. And then there are racers who don't know as much about the technical side. And I think I have a happy medium of really being technically literate with the vehicle and with the race car, and also understanding some outside applications as well.
I also remember interviewing some years back, gosh, probably 15 years ago, there was a guy who had just graduated from MIT who had made it to the major leagues. He was in his first spring training with, I think it was the San Diego Padres, and we talked about the fine line between taking a sophisticated intellectual approach but not overthinking things. Has that ever been an issue for you?
That's a great question. And yeah, it has, to be perfectly honest. You know, sometimes you can get so focused on the process and overthinking, and I think that's how drivers tend to psych themselves out a little bit, whether or not they have a higher education background. But sometimes you just have to go by the seat of your pants, right? You just have to do what feels right. You have to do what your gut tells you. In racing, some of the best passes or the most iconic passes for wins or for whatever position, they don't come from a calculated effort. They come because you're in a position and you make the gut instinct to make a move. And so it is a really fine balance, and one that I'm glad other people are experiencing in other sports.
So let me ask you a strange question. Where in all of this that you do did your year, your season on Survivor come in?
Great question. So I tried out and got accepted to be on Survivor when I was 20 years old. So it was my sophomore year of college. Now, when I was in college, I still raced every season, but I only did a handful of races during the summer. So it was a partial season. And what I did was in that year, we filmed in 2012, and I didn't have a whole lot lined up for racing. And so I got this opportunity and I just decided, you know what, I got to go for it. This is so cool. And hopefully it'll, help my racing image. It didn't really very much, but that was my fault. And I got back in end of May or beginning of June, and but then I actually went racing a few months later after I had adequately rehabbed and regained my strength. So it was astonishing. Really weird.
Well, if life is a collection of experiences, this is one of them, right?
Definitely. And, people ask me if I would do it again, and I would love to redeem myself. I think I made a strategic error. But at the same time, it would be so hard for me to justify not going racing for it. So it's the kind of thing where, when you have these opportunities, you got to take them and really make the most of them, because you don't know if you'll get them again. So, to your point, you've got to grab life by the horns and really make the best of it.
So you are speaking at a women's leadership event in Milwaukee. That is why we're speaking. You speak at a lot of events about your racing career, but also your educational background, your entrepreneurship, your place as a role model. That is a lot to put on one person.
Yeah, but I guess I like keeping busy. And it's really exciting to get on stage and to be very vulnerable with an audience and then kind of share their enthusiasm for what you're saying. And the way I see it is that if I'm able to positively impact one person, if I'm able to make one person think critically about themselves or make some change or readjust their outlook on the world, then that's a success. And my first talk was actually at TEDx Stanford, and it was really great because I got some coaching and I was in a comfortable environment, and I found that I was experiencing an adrenaline rush, not quite as intense as what I get on the racetrack, but it was still there, and it still requires that preparation and getting on stage and being vulnerable and putting it all out there. And so it's definitely a lot, but there's a lot of satisfaction in making a big group of people laugh and, you know, also learning what doesn't work so well. So it's really cool and it's fun to talk with people afterwards. So I'm glad I get to make the trip out there.
Do you get to be vulnerable on stage in a way that you can't afford to be when you're on a racetrack?
That's a really good question. Yeah, I think because there's no direct competition when I'm on stage, it's definitely a little different. And, you know, I don't have some of these more intimate life lesson and learning experience conversations with my competitors or with my crew even that I have with the audience. So, yeah, it definitely is an outlet that you don't necessarily get at the racetrack.
There's obviously a lot of danger in a race car going 200 miles an hour, inches from a wall. But are there things that scare you in anything that you do that might surprise people?
Yeah, so racing is definitely scary. It's really reassuring to know that these cars are almost built to take a hit, and so they look really terrifying and scary, but really it's because the car absorbs all the energy of a crash so the driver doesn't. So they're actually quite safe, and it's been over a decade since there's been a death in NASCAR, so that's great. But the first time you go 174, 175 miles an hour really catches your attention. But yeah, when it comes to fears, I think, one, everyone has them, and I think using fear to help motivate you to go forward is a really crucial skill that's worth working on and developing. And I think probably the biggest fear that I have that people can relate to is a fear of failure. And whether that was when I was at school, whether it's with my career as a race car driver, fear of not making it is definitely terrifying. And it's more abstract, so it's hard to wrap your head around. But the desire to not fail, I think, is part of what helps me keep after it and keep, you know, hustling so much to make my dreams come true.
How long had you been racing when you had your first crash?
Oh, I crashed my go-kart early on. But my first really big crash in a car, I think I had one where it was on a road course, so you turn left and right. So I was 14 at this time. It was a year that I won a championship, but on one of the practice days before I won that race, I dropped two wheels, like the two right side wheels, off of the racetrack and into the grass. And when grass is wet, it's very, very, very slippery, and it's hard to slow down. So it had rained the night before, and I just shot into the outside barrier, which is probably a good 30 or 40 feet from the track, but I just had so much speed that I crashed that. And there's a lot more damage to the car than like what I felt, but it's terrible. It's awful. You know, it's expensive. You know, you're not going to be able to get back in the car for a little while. And so you try to avoid it at all costs.
So Danica Patrick is retiring after, I think, what, Daytona and the Indianapolis 500. What did her career mean to yours?
Yeah, that's a great question and one that's quite common, but I think is very different to every female racer out there. And for me, you know, I totally applaud her being the first woman in modern, you know, modern racing to really continuously compete at the top level of NASCAR. I'm not sure I would want to be the first. And it was really cool in her, you know, more recent times to hear some of the struggles that she felt like with respect to how teams treated her and how other drivers treated her on track. Because it's all stuff that I've experienced as well. And from a branding perspective, I would probably do some things differently. So I think what's really cool is that even though we're both fairly petite brunette female race car drivers, she has such a different brand from what I have. And I feel like I still have plenty of room to be myself. And I think in no matter what industry, once there's one female that's prominent, sometimes, unfortunately, it seems like people are like, okay, you know, we've got our one, we don't need another. And I think that there's a lot of room to continue to be my own person, my own brand, in a field that has had such a prominent female role model. So, multifaceted answer to your question, but that's it. Yeah.
Well, and I guess I thought about Danica Patrick and thinking about all the various aspects of your life in which you serve as a role model. There are plenty of male NASCAR drivers just as NASCAR drivers. Is it fair for you to have all these other things, or is it just something that you welcome?
I mean, overall, it's something that I welcome. And when it comes to the gender question, like, I think many female racers would agree that they'd like to be known as a great race car driver. They wouldn't want to be just a great female race car driver, right? Because there are only a handful of us. So what's that really saying? But I do think it's important to have the conversation about the significance of women really starting to break through from a driving side, but then also from an engineering side and a, you know, mechanic side, because there are only so many women in the garage. And so in terms of having that conversation, I think at this stage is crucial. When we see, you know, 50-50 representation of men and women, then the conversation doesn't have to be as loud, in my opinion. But until we see that, and I think that's culturally, until we see women getting paid equally, until we see, you know, more safety for women, I mean, we need to have these conversations. So the fact that I have different things going on to my brand and my platform than just racing, I think is a really cool opportunity to continue to spread that message.
All right. Well, let me ask you the question to end that I'm sure you get a lot. When you are not on the track, what kind of car do you drive, and what kind of driver are you?
Yeah, I drive a Volkswagen GTI, stick shift manual, very important.
Oh yeah.
And I am a driver that sets cruise control, because when you get one too many tickets, you just decide it's not worth it anymore. So, but I'll be honest, I don't love driving on the road. On the racetrack, I can be really offensive and everything. And I think on the road, I have to be way more defensive. So, as much as other people can drive me around, I'll take it.
Well, listen, Julia Landauer, it was a thrill to get to chat with you. Thank you so much for your time, your insights, and everything you do.
Thank you. And everyone is free to reach out on social media. I love engaging with fans. So at Julia Landauer is where I'm at. And it's always fun to hear from you guys.
Julia Landauer is a NASCAR driver and a STEM education and women's advocate. The Stanford grad in science, technology, and society will give the keynote later this month at Mount Mary University's Voices of Leadership event. You'll find a link to more information at wuwm.com.